ask. I'll send Rachel a.
Well, welcome everybody to the March 23rd, 2015 meeting of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. We got a number of bills up today, and I think we're going to start out with Senate Bill 33. So we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 33. James.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 33 appropriates money from general fund to Oregon Department of Administrative Services for State Fair Council for conducting Oregon State Fair, carrying out fairground business operations, or operating state fairground properties and facilities. Declares emergency effective July 1st, 2015. There is a dash one amendment, appropriates $3.75 million out of the general fund for the biennium beginning July 1st, 2015 for the operation of the State Fair Council and Oregon State Fair and startup expenses. Appropriates $7,475,000 out of the general fund for the biennium beginning July 1st, 2015, which may be expended for the repair, deferred maintenance, or insurance of state fairground properties and facilities, or for capital expenditures for buildings, furniture, fixtures, or equipment. There is no revenue impact, and there is a fiscal impact.
So that's an ominous-looking front line there. But if the two current legislators want to come up first, since it came out of your committees.
No, this is separate. I'm here.
This is separate. You don't want to have anything to do with him, huh?
This is
all right.
Make sure his committee's last today.
Welcome.
Thank you very
Senate
much.
Roblin.
Chair Beyer.
Senator Gerfler.
Committee. For the record, Arnie Roblin, Senate District 5, the Oregon Coast. I'm sitting here today because I wanted to be involved in the formation of the new state board. For the fair. And our esteemed president assigned me that task as a non-voting member of the newly established fair board. And we were given a task to try to make the fair sustainable over time with the understanding that the last year after we did the legislation, we had to form a fair council. We had to figure out how to transfer the assets from the state parks to this new governmental entity called the State Fair, and then we had to run the fair, keep it going while we were doing that. Well, you know, as they say, changing the tires as the car is moving down the road, and then to come back to you this year as a newly formed group with a newly hired CEO to explain what we're doing and why, and to ask you to help us with our budget as we make this transition to becoming fully sustainable. Part of the problem that we're facing and the reason this bill is so important to us is that at the end of the last year, one of the questions, one of the requirements was that we would help with state parks to submit a budget through the executive branch, and they would take that budget, state parks, and send it to DAS to be included in the governor's budget. We sent that to DAS. It didn't go any farther. They didn't actually have the conversation about it, and we have information about that. But it did not get to the governor for them to make a decision with regard to whether they should have funded in this year's budget. And so we felt very clearly we had to put a bill in so we could have that conversation. That's the bill you see in front of you. And it basically is saying we need $3.75 million to start working on that. Continue the work that we've already started on the transition and to move forward with the operational costs of a state fair while we start to raise some money. By having a state fair, by working with making the grounds usable all year long, so we actually start making sure that it is advertised and we get people there. And then the other thing is what we have found out, and there's some information out there if you want, that shows the extent to which we have not put any money into the fair buildings, and so they are deteriorating pretty rapidly. From roofs to other things, there's a very large amount of money. I think one study said about $50 million, and that did not include the roofs. We understand that we have to take over that responsibility, but we're asking the state to step up, and that's what the little over $7 million is about, is getting some of those immediate repairs taken care of. So what we're saying is we look forward to the job of being on the state fair. I have been impressed with the people who have been appointed to the state fair board and their work and their commitment to making it happen. I am pleased that the county fairs are working really closely with us so we can organize that. And for those of us that live in rural communities, and I think those that live in urban communities, having a state fair is a really important thing for our state. It's a highlight of the year for a lot of the kids from my old high school and a highlight for a lot of people in rural communities. But it's one of the few times that some of our urban friends get to come in and intermix and see these 4-H kids and other people doing the things that they do. And I think it's an important part of who we are as a state. So I would encourage you to pass this bill on to Ways and Means and then have that conversation down there with respect to how we're going to keep funding it and so that we have a firm footing with our board and the new administration that you're going to hear from today as we move forward to show you the what we can do as this new quasi-governmental entity, the state fair. So with that, any questions you might have? I have another meeting.
Any questions to Senator Roblin?
Thank you.
You were moving there. I wasn't sure. You're never sure with him. Senator Driftwood.
It's really been great. So I'll leave it and see you later.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Gene Durfler, and I'm chairing the State Fair Council. And Arnie's covered pretty much what I was going to tell you about, but I will repeat some of it. As you know, after a study made about the fair, the recommendation was to take the fair from being a state agency into a public corporation, much like OHSU is. And I think that's really a good direction to go. I think we've been struggling with the state fair for many years, trying to figure out how to make it successful. And it really is very difficult to run an entrepreneurial type business using state rules. It's almost impossible. And state parks worked hard to do that, but there's too many things that make them so they're not competitive. And so changing it so that it would be sort of a free agency to run it in a business-like manner, I think, is the right direction to go from the fair, for the fair. And as you know, you passed Senate Bill 7 last session, and the governor appointed a board, and I would ask you to take a look at the list of board members we have on the letter there. It's very impressive, and we have some very good people on the board, which makes it a very strong board, and I think there's no one on the board that doesn't feel that we won't be successful in making this transition. We've been meeting once a month, sometimes more often than that, and we've been learning and trying to figure out how fairs operate. It's a different kind of business than most of us have been in, but it still has the basic rules of business, and that's take care of the customer. I don't know if many of you know about the Oregon State Fair, but does anyone know who was President of the United States when we had the first Oregon Fair?
Cleveland? Any?
Teddy Roosevelt.
No, it was Abraham Lincoln.
Oh. Yeah.
So you can understand that it's a long tradition to have a fair. And so, and over those years, you know, there's been a lot of changes in the culture and in the country, and especially in Oregon. And the fairs, as a rule, we visited some fairs. Some of them have been very successful. Example, the state of Washington, which is an independent fair, has been very successful. And we visited some fairs that are struggling to keep it put together. So. I think there's a. If you went back 100 years, you would find the state fair was probably one of the biggest events in the whole state. But because the culture changes, and because of the options people have now, the state fairs are not as prevalent, not as successful as they have been many years back. But agriculture is still a big producer in our economy, and it does give us an opportunity to present that industry to the people. And also point out that if you notice, there's a lot of 4-H kids here today, and I wasn't aware of it, but there's 110,000 people in Oregon involved in 4-H. A lot of kids. And a lot of kids come to the fair after they're successful in the county fairs. So it's a real opportunity for not only 4-H, but The FFA is also a very good program, and I think they deserve some consideration in providing a place for them to show their products. So what we need to do is build a bigger presence for the fair, and all of our board members are convinced, as I am, that we can make it successful. And the first thing that we have to do, of course, is make a budget. And I'm going to let Mike Polisak cover the budget with you. We've made up a budget of what we think is necessary to make the fair operate, and we're hoping that you will consider it and pass on the ways and means where I know that we're going to have to do a big selling job. So with that, Mike.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Gerard, members of the committee. My name is Mike Polisak. I'm the director and CEO of the Oregon State Fair and Exposition Center. I've been an Oregonian for all of about 2 months now, but I'm happy to be here and excited about this opportunity. SB 17 provides the unprecedented, or excuse me, SB 7 provided the unprecedented opportunity in our industry to operate free from many of the government constraints that hamper our ability to be successful. I've been in this business for 35 years, and I've said for many of those that government and fairs are a bad fit. I believe that we operate an entrepreneurial enterprise. We try to do so, and I've managed state agency fairs, county agency fairs, in a very bureaucratic environment. We're not really entrepreneurs. We're not really bureaucrats. I coined the phrase years ago that we're entrepreneurocrats. But this opportunity is really what excited me about coming to Oregon, about being part of the state fair and part of something that our industry is watching carefully, because this is a business model that, when we prove it successful, would become a model for others to follow. We've worked very closely with State Parks and Lisa Van Lannen, their director, MG, their assistant director, making a very smooth transition. We're nearly complete with that transition. There's only a few things that remain to that we still overlap, and that's really with DAS, not so much State Parks. And we appreciate the work that and the support that we've received from State Parks as we make the adjustment. Our goal is not just to survive, but to thrive. We want to be, will be, a fair that the people of Oregon can be proud of. Fairs educate, entertain, and inform. We're a lifelong learning institution about agriculture, our communities, commerce. The heart of the fair, what makes us different from any other institution, schools, libraries, museums, other events, public facilities, is our competitive exhibits program. Livestock, other agriculture, what we refer to as living arts, photography, fine arts. Fairs celebrate the best of the best, and the state fair celebrates the best of the best of the best. We showcase what's good. We tell a great story. We grow champions and the next generation of leaders. Gene referred to 4-H and FFA. They're probably the best example of the product that State Fair produces. We're very proud of them and their program, and we're happy to partner with them. The mission of the council is to conduct the State Fair, promote tourism, and operate the Exposition Center here in Salem. We're also host to the Marion County Fair, and are happy to be part of that that event as well. In order to thrive, we believe that we need to do four things. We need to increase our viability. We need to improve our livability, be more user-friendly, be more welcoming. We need to enhance our memorability. We need people to think of us fondly when they leave events, whether they be the State Fair, the Marion County Fair, other events that we hold at the State Fairgrounds during the year. We want them to leave with good memories and feel like they're part of, have ownership of the State Fair. And finally, the one thing that one of two major things that I believe have caused not just this fair but many fairs to struggle is we don't exploit our marketability. We And it's a bit of a global problem within our industry, but we have the opportunity to overcome that. We don't actively market our facility. We do a fairly good job marketing the State Fair event, but we wait for people to come to us to say, "Gee, we'd like to rent the facilities," and that's not effective. I make the comparison that that's like going fishing and putting a bucket on the bow of the boat and sitting back with your arms crossed waiting for fish to jump in the bucket. That's not the best way to fish. We need to actively promote the fair, the exposition center. SB 33 gives us the tools to move swiftly to operate the fair and the expo center successfully, to improve our programs and our facilities. We are starting, as Gene said, we're starting a brand new business that's 150 years old. I make a slightly different comparison that we're rebuilding the engine while it's running. We have a good state fair. We have a good year-round operation. That continues, that will continue, but we need to create a new business model. We need to operate differently in order to be successful. Our ask today is to provide us with the funding necessary to do that, to give us a certain amount of money, the $7 million, to address millions and millions of dollars of decades worth of unaddressed deferred maintenance that in many cases have resulted from lack of ongoing maintenance. The facilities, in my opinion, are a diamond in the rough. They do need work, but and this bill would provide us with some funding to begin to address what we believe are some real critical issues, as well as with any new business, there is startup funding necessary. There's things that have to change, things that need to be started over. We believe that this provides us with the leg up that we need to not only be successful, but to thrive. We're grateful to Senator Courtney for authoring SB 7, to Senator Roblin for authoring this bill, SB 33. He truly understands from being an advisor to the council what our needs are, what our goals are, what our opportunity for success is. And we would ask that you send this to Ways and Means with a recommendation to approve. And we thank you for your support of the State Fair.
Thank you both. Questions? Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, if I may. I, as a former 4-H member myself, I know that this is a place where young people get a great experience. They get an increased self-awareness and self-confidence that leads to them becoming great citizens, whether they're going into a farm or other areas. And I think this is a great bill. Thank you.
Other questions? Senator Gerard?
Yeah, I actually have a question, and either one of you might not have the answer. Just get back to me before Ways and Means. And I'm kind of curious as to the cost of your liability insurance. Do you have any idea how much that is?
Well, in Senate Bill, my understanding, there's two different liabilities that are available for agencies like ourselves. And when Senate Bill 7 was passed, it didn't put us in either category. So in our next bill that we will probably have before you, we've asked to be put in a particular area so we know what our liability would be. Uh-huh. I think our liability, as I recall in the budget, last year was like $125,000 for liability insurance.
That's not as bad as I thought it might be.
So, Senator, we talked about this, but I assume when we created the public corporation or created, we'd want to include it under the state tort cap.
That's what we're asking for. Mm-hmm.
So we have to make sure we do that right.
Yeah. Don't follow it up.
Senator Thompson?
Thank you. Yeah, this question's for either one, too. I've heard in the past the actual state fair itself breaks even or makes money. Is that true?
That's correct.
And the Marion County Fair is the same?
I can't speak to the Marion County Fair. I'm not sure if anybody from the Marion County Fair is here.
So the loser is, what do you do with the fairgrounds? the rest of the year, and that's
correct.
That's what you're
doing. The year-round operation is really what's not profitable. The fair itself is profitable.
Yeah.
Not to say that there isn't room for growth and improvement. There is,
sure,
but certainly it's not sufficient to subsidize the year-round operation.
Thank you.
It's fair to say, describe it as the event's successful, but the event by itself will not sustain the facility.
That's correct.
Other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank
Senator,
you.
Good to see you again. Representatives, did you wish to comment on this?
I'm waiting for the Senate.
You're waiting.
They're looking at a different bill.
Huh? She's in committee.
What? Different bill? I'm on the Fair Council and backup.
All righty. Well, that's all I had signed up to testify. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this? A lot of 4-H'ers out there today. You're welcome. Please.
My name is Cheyenne Young. I'm from Crick County. I've been in 4-H for 11 years. I'm a state 4-H ambassador as well as participating in dog, horse, and sheep 4-H projects and horse FFA. I've participated in state fairs since I was allowed to go in seventh grade, and I've continually seen a lot of struggles with the conditions of the fairground and being able, there's a lot of clashing of facilities and that sort of thing. Last year, myself as well as many other 4-H'ers and FFA members in the Horse Project were extremely disappointed when fair had to be canceled because the condition in the arena wasn't good enough for gaming. And so I was actually loading up my horse and getting ready to leave when my advisor caught me last minute and told me that they had canceled state fair. And that was something I had prepared for months at that point. And it was really difficult to hear that that had been canceled because there wasn't proper maintenance in the arena and that it was unsafe for our horses to be in there.
Mm. Okay, thank you very much.
Yes.
Anybody else? No, one more. Two more. Come on down.
Hi, my name is Sam Eisenhelder. I've been in 4-H for over 11 years. I've been privileged to do a lot of different opportunities through the program, and State Fair is definitely one of the biggest highlights that has come across to me. A big thing for me, as it allowed me an opportunity to learn leadership skills, to work with adults and partnerships, to work with the public, being able to present different projects and numerous opportunities. And last year, with a lot of like budget cuts and other things, kind of like what Cheyenne was saying, it was just really hard for me to see so much that I had learned and taken a lot away from to not necessarily go to all the kids that are still coming up through the program.
Thank you.
So my name's Caitlin Davis. I'm from Yamhill County. I've been in 4-H for about 8 years now. As far as the 4-H fairs go, it's amazing to see what the kids do and how they're maturity and growth goes in learning marketing and business skills, public communication, animal handling, and agricultural science. And so I help work with kids who are in the foster system or have a bit of a hard family life. And as far as fair goes, that is their main highlight, their way to say, okay, I started here, but if I can make it to fair, then maybe I can make it through life as well. And so it's been an amazing experience, especially as they make it to state fair and realize that their small world, that may not be the best, it may not be the prettiest, but there's a bigger world out there that offers so much for their future. So as far as state fair goes, the importance of it and the maintenance to be able to keep that up so further generations can be able to go through that as well.
Thank you both. Is there anybody else? Okay, thank you. Last chance. Anybody else want to talk? Okay. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 33. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 33. The chair moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 33. Discussion on that motion? Is there any opposition to that motion? There is none. We'll The dash ones are adopted. The chair moves Senate Bill 33 as amended by the dash ones, and that the bill be recommended for. I'm saying this moves that the bill be moved to the floor with the due pass with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
It's a kind of a strange way to do it, isn't it?
It is, but that's the way it is. It's got money attached to it. It has to go to Ways and Means.
No, I understand the Ways and Means, but it's got to go to the floor and then go to Ways and Means.
It actually doesn't go to the floor first. It just does. Never mind. Any discussion on the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, Senate Bill 33 is moved to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 33. Thank you very much for everyone on that. Now we've got a series of bills here that we're going to open up at one time. So let's see. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bills 100, Senate Bill 101, Senate Bill 515, and what's the other one?
596.
Welcome to the committee, and Representative Wisman.
He's a representative. He's been here a long time. Doesn't he have anything to do?
Yes, James.
You've been here all afternoon. Don't you have to?
Hold on just a second here. Let my staff go through this.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 100 directs Oregon Business Development Department in consultation with Department of Consumer and Business Services to conduct study regarding state regulation of businesses and persons engaged in occupations. Requires report to Legislative Assembly on or before December 31st, 2016. Sunsets on January 1st, 2018. Declares emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue impact, and the fiscal there is a fiscal impact that's indeterminate. Senate Bill 101. Creates Joint Legislative Committee to review agency regulation of Oregon businesses. Directs committee to research, study, and compile data regarding processes, requirements, and fees imposed by state agencies upon Oregon businesses and persons engaged in occupations. Requires report to Legislative Senate no later than December 31st, 2016. Allows committee to introduce legislation to implement recommendations. Sunset committee on June 30th, 2025. There is no revenue impact, and there's a fiscal impact for that. And then Senate Bill 515 directs Department of Administrative Services to provide method for users to offer suggestions regarding the form or content of the website or the homepage of the website. Requires the posting of economic development information related to Oregon Product Investment Fund, qualified research tax credits, beginning and expanding farmer loan program, Oregon Innovation Council, and strategic investment program. Requires posting of annual reports regarding certain tax expenditures. Requires posting of description of process for requesting public records from public bodies. Enables local governments to post notices of public meetings. We do have a dash one amendment for Senate Bill 515, removes posting reference to names of taxpayers who claim credit for qualified research expenses. No revenue impact, and there's a minimal fiscal impact.
That was a lot, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, you loaded me up today, Mr. Chair. Okay, for the record, Senator Kim Thatcher from Senate District 13, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to speak on behalf of, well, three different bills today.
Four.
Total. once we get
just
through
please
the
identify
all
which
of
one you commented on.
Yes. The aim here is to make it easier to do business here in Oregon, as well as increase transparency of government and economic development programs. So, starting with Senate Bill 100, what does the bill do? First, I'll give you a little bit of background information. Last session, over time, and I'm sure you've had many discussions with your constituents and many but small business owners, perhaps saying business needs to deal with a lot of regulation. What can we do to decrease regulation? Well, it's such an ethereal, comment. Okay, what regulation? Which regulation should we reduce? And so you try to point at it. So this was a way of trying to get our arms around it. I sat down in a room with many business representatives and agency representatives that do, like Business Oregon, Department of Consumer and Business Services, as well as the Secretary of State's office, and all that. And we decided that maybe some foundational work needs to be done. And that's what Senate Bill 100 aims to do. And it's directing the Oregon Business Development Department and Department of Consumer and Business Services to conduct a study. Now, that's where the foundational work comes in. And it's regarding the state business regulation and The study aims to find barriers to business and for licensed professionals that have a negative impact on either setting up business, maintaining your business, or actually moving your business here, and as well as those in occupations, because sometimes those occupations set up business like plumbers, you know, et cetera, that have a direct impact on business and setting up business. The departments will obtain feedback from both the businesses and the licensed individuals through surveys, focus groups, or other means. And departments may also collaborate with other data that's already out there. Some of the institutions of higher learning have already done some of these studies. I know Business Oregon conducted, I don't know if you call it a study, but they've gathered a lot of information over the summer and over time that we could use to leverage some of this information and figure out where we need to go as a legislature to maybe start targeting some of the some of the regulation that may need to be streamlined a bit. So, as a business owner myself, I know firsthand the difficulty associated with navigating sometimes often a complex set of rules and regulations imposed by state agencies. Senate Bill 100 will help state government identify rules and regulations that negatively impact businesses and individuals in licensed occupations in order to increase competition, productivity, efficiency, and job creation by firms and individuals here in Oregon. So that's Senate Bill 100. Now, okay. Senate Bill 101, it creates the joint legislative...
Yeah. Senator Monroe?
You know that Senate Bill 100 is a very famous name.
Yeah.
Bill Hansel's uncle sponsored Senate Bill 100 in 1973.
We should have a bill to retire some of these numbers, Ivo. Because they kind of get...
Stafford Hansel's bill was pretty famous.
Yes, I agree. It is a very famous... maybe this one could
I'm
get fully implemented,
unlike stuff.
Senate Bill 100 to get fully implemented. But anyhow, Senate Bill 101 creates a joint legislative committee to review agency regulation of Oregon businesses, kind of like the joint... how we set up the Joint Committee on Tax Credit Review. It was kind of copying that sort of model. The committee will research processes and requirements imposed by state agencies upon businesses and those in licensed occupations to obtain or renew licenses, permits, certificates, registrations, all that's required to conduct business or engage in occupation in Oregon. The committee will take into account the amount of time taken to obtain or renew licenses, permits, certificates, and registrations, and the committee will investigate the types and amounts of fees imposed by state agencies upon businesses and licensees in order for businesses or licensees to obtain all these things. I'll just call them licenses for shortness. And the committee will evaluate the efficacy and efficiency of these processes. The committee will also be able to obtain recommendation to improve state-required process, maybe streamline things a little bit. So, why pass the bill? The aim of this bill is to increase the ease of doing business and obtaining licensing for specific occupations and increasing the efficiency and efficacy of state requirements and processes in the state. And it'll help grow our economy and increase competition and create jobs. And if you'd like me to go on to Senate Bill 515, I'll do that. All right, thank you. Senate Bill 515 is a continuation of my and other legislators' efforts to increase transparency in the state. In 2009, House Bill 2500 was the first step in a line of bills aimed at improving transparency. This bill includes a number of actions aimed at increasing government and economic development program transparency. Specifically, it would require the Department of Administrative Services to provide a method for users of the Oregon Transparency website to offer suggestions regarding form or content of the website. So basically, establishing a more collaborative approach for maintaining and actually setting up the website, usability of the system. And also, more the nitty-gritty of the bill, requires DAS to provide an economic development section on the Oregon Transparency website for posting information about specific economic development programs. There are some, a lot of the economic development programs are already posted on there. This would just add some other ones, like film, the filmmakers, the Oregon Production Investment Fund, and information about, I have an amendment that would take out the one listed in the bill for qualified research expenses and the amount of the credit, because there was angst over the fact that it's closely tied to a federal, the federal income tax form, and by so doing, you'd kind of maybe run afoul of confidentiality issues. So I'm offering the Dash 1 amendment to take that out for now.
Okay.
But it would also include information about the beginning and expanding farmer loan program and the Oregon Innovation Council, and include copies or links to the annual reports required under ORS. Well, anyway, the business development income tax exemption. It would also post information describing the process for requesting copies of public records from a public body to make it very clear in one spot, so the public knows what the processes are for the different agencies out there. Okay, and then you could get a link to that. It would also allow for local agencies to bring in their public, not their public rights, but their public meeting notices. We already have that for state and state meetings and for schools. Those are posted. It's a very nice website if you haven't seen that already. But this would allow for local governments to link into that. And it would have DAS post copies of any annual reports that agencies are required to produce regarding administration of certain economic development programs and incentives. The point was to increase government transparency, increase access to information necessary for citizens to hold government accountable. And that is that. I'll take a breath now.
That's good.
Any
take
questions?
Did you want to comment while you're here on 596 as well, which I don't think I had staff read?
Well, I just wanted to make a comment on 596. I noticed Friday that it was on the agenda, and it did come out of the Committee on Workforce, of which I am a vice chair. And I noticed it was up for a hearing and possible work session. I just wanted to mention, because I do employ flaggers in my business, that I had nothing to do with the bill, and nor did I don't know who the proponents are, nor what the genesis is. And though it could possibly benefit my business, I don't. I just wanted to state for the record, I had nothing to do with the bill. So there,
an abundance of caution.
Overabundance of caution. There you go.
All right. So questions to the senator. Senator
On Senate Bill 100. I like the crux of the bill. The problem I have, if I have a problem, is that you're asking DCBS to kind of to do a study of themselves with Oregon Business Development Department. I'm just wondering, I know you have a committee that could be formed if they wanted to, that they could draw off expertise, but I'm just wondering how objective you think that can be, given the fact that it's kind of an overview of yourself, and agencies that do that tend to have glowing reports.
I don't know. It's a study of themselves so much. It's to conduct a study to determine barriers to business that exist as a result of state agency policy. Well, I guess it may sound like that, but it was for the point of it to be that they would... It would leverage information maybe that's already out there. It was to kind of cut down on the fiscal. When we were discussing how this would work, and in our meetings, it was to, there's so much information that's already out there and has already been discussed, whether it's been done through PSU or through OSU or U of O. I mean, there are a number of little studies that maybe we can aggregate, and we can put them together, and we can just kind of use that rather than reinventing the wheel completely. And that's really what we wanted to do. And maybe that was more of what was intended by the the wording there, but rather than starting from scratch, that's really what the intention is, to utilize what's already out there.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And honorable committee members, for the record, I'm Gene Wisden, House District 53. Mr. Chair, I was not here to speak on Senate Bill 100 and 101, or 596, but I endorse those bills. I think they're good pro-business bills, and Oregon should be concerned about that, especially after our congressman recently talked about how unfriendly we are to businesses in Oregon. So I would support the committee hearing those bills and moving those bills forward in some way. I'm really here to Senator Thatcher asked me to come and talk about Senate Bill 515. Senator Monroe, I think House Bill 2500 in the 2009 session should be up there on that pedestal, or getting close to the pedestal of famous bills for Oregon. That bill was passed in the 2009 session. Representative Senator Thatcher, Arnie Roblin, myself, and Jefferson Smith were the key sponsors of that bill. And it set up a website, Transparency or Taxpayers website, that has now earned a rating of A. Transparency websites for states, and we've done that at no cost, additional cost, other than the people at DASA's salaries that are doing this. And I think all of the proposals that Senator Thatcher had proposed being added to that website would even help Oregon now in its other crisis as far as transparency and ethics, as far as putting information out there. So I would really encourage the committee to pass 515, I guess, dash one, now that took care of the one thing. So the senator just asked me to come here and show my support, and I do support that, Senator, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions, Representative? Well, thank you both. Okay, so let's see. We're just going to start down the list on, I think we're going to take comments on 100, 101, and 515, and then we'll deal with 596 afterwards. So I'm going to start up with those who have signed up for 100. Evo Trummer. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Evo Trummer. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for the Oregon Business Development Department, of Business Oregon for short. I'm here to talk today. Senator Thatcher asked me to talk to Senate Bill 100. Before I go to the bill and our thoughts about the more detail there, I just wanted to, with your indulgence, spend a couple of minutes to speak about Business Oregon. The department's mission is, in a nutshell, to grow Oregon jobs, companies, and communities statewide. We do this. Our main strategies to accomplish this is to expand existing Oregon businesses, nurture innovation and startups, recruit traded sector employers, key industries, and build infrastructures for communities to grow statewide. Our main focus, if you will, in all this is, and this is the handout that that you have in front of you, is to grow our own, to focus first and foremost on the companies that are already here, because the data is very strong that the majority of the job creation in any typical American community comes from the companies already in that community. I always say that after, say, we also still are in the recruitment game, obviously, but our focus in all our efforts is, and you see sort of the business units that we have, is to grow our own companies first. I always say that the title of our strategy was pre the legalization vote, but it tells the story here very well. To Senate Bill 100, what I wanted to say, a couple of things, is we've had the opportunity to talk to Senator Thatcher a number of times about the bill and her intent. I will start with saying that Business Oregon is not a regulatory agency. We don't regulate or we don't issue licenses, but we obviously have a great interest in the business environment in our state. Since we have no expertise in licensing or regulation, it makes good sense that this partners us with the DCPS, who do license. I can't speak for DCPS, but I will point out that they don't do all the licenses in the state or all regulation in the state. Numerous bodies out there. The one concern that both agencies will have is that the scope of the study is very broadly defined, if you will. And the question, the push and pull, will be between the resources available to us and the expectations, I think, by the legislature, what that study will will entail. If the intent, and certainly we can do this at no cost to the state, but then it will be a very narrow, I think, study or report on possibly the all the occupations that need licenses, fee schedule that's associated with applying to it or a renewal. I will say that a good survey, we just used a federal grant passed through to us by the PUC actually last year to do broadband utilization in Oregon. That had a sample size of about 4,000 folks on the phone, and that gives you a very good idea about broadband utilization, but the costs associated with that kind of survey are pretty dramatic, I would say. So without funding attached, there's a limited amount that we can do, and we just want to make sure that the expectations are in line with whatever funding might or might not be available here. With that, I think I'm happy to answer any questions.
You may not. I can't remember where you were during the first Governor Kulongowski's first term, but as I recall, there was a rather large gubernatorial-directed effort to do pretty much what this bill is intended to do. And the staff person is actually staffed by Business Oregon, different name then. And I believe, as I recall, that the staff person who did that, it was a pretty good report, currently sits as the director of DCBS.
That's helpful to know. Unfortunately, I think they had a scheduling conflict. Otherwise, they probably would be here. Ian would remind you happily that they did that report.
It might be good to go back and review that and find out what happened in the interim. Questions of Eva? Thank you very much. Appreciate you being here. Carl Harbaugh and Jan Meekums. Whoever wishes to go first.
Okay. Chair Beyer and members of the committee, my name is Jan Meekums. I'm the state director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. We're an association of 7,000 privately owned small businesses throughout the state, most of which have less than 10 employees. So, and I'm here to say that we support Senate Bill 100 and Senate Bill 101 conceptually, as I have submitted written testimony, and there's a document in there that's regulatory facts sheet on the effect of regulation on small businesses, and it's pretty dramatic. We do a monthly survey of our members. We have 7,000 in Oregon and about 350,000 nationwide. And for 65 straight months, the number one concern and barrier that our members reported was regulation. So anything that can be done to begin to unburden regulation for our small businesses. We certainly agree on the intent of regulation to protect the environment, protect the consumers, protect the employee. All of those purposes are very laudatory. I think that if we had the capacity to review some of these regulations, we might find that some are antiquated. Some of them may be overburdensome and can be streamlined. So anything in that direction, we are very supportive of. One thing that occurred in 2013 out of the Secretary of State's office introduced two bills, one to create a portal where agencies would report to, which we supported, and also the Office of Small Business Assistance. Both of those passed, and I think that they also are a step in the right direction. With 180 agencies and over 11,000 pages of regulation that small businesses are expected to know and abide by, it is overwhelming. So we just encourage you to take a look at these bills and move them along, and to bring more than just an aerial view of regulation. Carl Harbaugh is here as a small business owner to give you some more specific detail of regulation and how it affects a small business. And I thank you for your time today, and I'm open to any questions.
Thank you, Jan. Mm-hmm. Sir.
Yeah, my name is Carl Harbaugh, and I operate a small glass company here in Salem. My wife and I started this company, I would say, 36, 37 years ago. She and I independently started the company, and we've evolved to now I have somewhere between 35 and 45 employees. We do commercial glazing and contract all over the state and in other states as well. And I feel as though there's at least two or three people in my office that spend their entire time dealing with aspects of regulations and rules and regulations and things that are very cumbersome to continue on with our business. And it doesn't seem like we've got ups and downs in the economy. We have to grow and shrink. We have to change what we do, the way we do it. We have, and then regulations change, employee requirements and testing for drug testing, all kinds of things go on, safe laws, insurance. Insurance is just an unbelievable, I mean, if you read an insurance policy, what you're covered and what you're not covered for, and this contract says you need to do this for this particular contract, and this you got to do for that contract. You almost have to be an attorney to deal with that part of it. Not to mention, I ended up in a circumstance whereby I'm trying to get the laws enforced, and it's years before I can get laws enforced that has really encumbered my business, and not a thing I can do about it but wait till it happens. I don't know how many small business members that are friends of mine that said, I'm done. I don't want to do this anymore. This isn't any fun anymore. I can think back when I very first started my business, it was enjoyable. I enjoyed it. And getting out there and working with my crew, and I couldn't, I mean, today I was out in the weather trying to measure some windows because I have some expertise, but I don't get much chance to do that because I'm sitting at that desk dealing with the things that I don't do. And when you've got people that are doing paperwork and not physically lifting and doing things, it costs you money. And it's just getting worse and worse and worse. And then not to mention the educational level that you have to deal with. You have to hire consultants to help you with finance and things. And I'm kind of spewing here a little bit, but it's just a tough, tough job. And it's not easy to do. And then you got these ups and downs. And a lot of people have failed in this business. And I don't know why anybody wants to start my business. I mean, it's just so hard to do anymore.
I'm curious, sir. You said you spent a lot of effort to get a law enforced. What area was that in?
It was in basically was embezzled and had money, and it hasn't even got to court yet. So
okay. And so this is someone who worked for you at that case.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I just don't. And the other thing, I think there's tools that could be implemented. Like, for instance, our lien rights. We have to go, every time we do a contract, we have to give a lien release from every purchaser we have for all this stuff. And it's just over and over and over again. And we do this, and a volume of papers going back and forth between the contractor, the owner, the lender, all this is going back. Is there a way to fix that? So we do work, we do it on time, we do it right, and it's almost like if we could get a grade A rating, we wouldn't have to go through all this because we don't have any lawsuits against us. We do things right. I don't know what the answers are, but if you really ask the businessman and come out and talk to him on an individual person-to-person basis, he'll tell you what really hurts and what takes time and why are we doing this over and over again. It's just redundant. It makes no sense whatsoever, but we do it.
Appreciate that. Questions? Senator Riley?
A couple of things. First of all, you know, I had my first meeting of my Small Business Advisory Council last Wednesday night and heard many of these same issues. But one of the things I heard as well was, you know, we're the ones who are doing this right, and we shouldn't have to do these. But we know there are folks out there who are the bad actors, and you know that's where the problems occur. I liked what you said about if we have a good A rating over a period of time, we could reduce some of the some of those restrictions, but it's always the bad actors that cause these regulations, and it's like any other area. If everybody did everything right, we wouldn't need any laws, but unfortunately they don't. And one of the things that I heard was, you know, the three groups of people that are meant to protect with these laws. The fourth one is the businesses themselves.
Yes.
And I like that idea. I hope we can maybe do something about that.
You know, I might comment, SAFE is has done a great job. I mean, they have created our insurance. I mean, if all state agencies work the way SAFE works, it's amazing. We gained a rating with them. Our safety, for example, is way, way down there. We know how much it costs us when we have an accident, we have a problem. So we're very, very concerned about it because it puts money back in our pockets. I don't know if there was more ways to do that. SAFE should get an A rating for the way they do business.
Good to know. Others?
Yeah, I got one.
Senator Jarrett?
Yeah, I like the bill. I'm just afraid it doesn't have enough teeth, but that's kind of going on the other side of where you guys are. I can give an example. I sat on a hospital board. The brackets for fire extinguishers for OSHA was at one level. For the state fire marshal was at the other, was at a different level, and they wouldn't agree. So no matter what level you put it at, you're in noncompliance. And I think business as general, there's just times when you're in that position, and we really need to streamline it. I personally think the solution is administrative rule curtailment, but that's something we have a dickens of a time. We've been trying to get that through since 93 or before. So I'd like this bill. I'd actually like to see it have more teeth, but we'll see what happens.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Thanks for coming down.
Thank you.
All right. Now, on 515, that's the other ones I've signed up. So, Dave Rosenfeld. Sean, Scott, you want to come up too? And we'll just take two at a time, I guess. Welcome.
Chair Byer, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Rosenfeld, Executive Director of OSPIRG, and thank you all for taking the time to hear our testimony today. I'll make it brief. I submitted written testimony along with a number of other documents that you can look into. So OSPIRG, in short, supports Senate Bill 515. We commend the representatives and senators who have put this forward. As Senator Thatcher and Representative Wisnant noted, this has been a long process that goes back to 2009 and would echo everything they said about how we are definitely making progress. OSPIRG's National Federation, USPIRG, has been doing a report every year for a number of years now, ranking all of the states and how well they're doing in making the stewardship of our tax dollars transparent. Oregon gets an A. I forget if we're four or five, but I think we're four. So we're doing pretty good, and we have been ascending over the years. The particular thing that I'd like to highlight about 515, and that'll really be all we'll say about it, is one of the things that we have focused on since the passage of House Bill 2009 is the disclosure of the details of economic development tax incentive programs. And the particular thing there is we have no position on the merits of these programs in this building. There are many different positions. Our only thing about that is that if we're going to be able to meaningfully evaluate the return on investment on these programs, there needs to be sufficient detail itemized that allows us to be able to evaluate that, which would be who's getting this money, how much money are they getting, what were the deliverables that were created, and then what were the actuals, essentially. Whether that's job creation or other forms of public benefit. And until very recently, that information was pretty much kept a secret. And not really important how or why or whatever, but it was really just not out there. And even some of the legislation that was attempted in recent years didn't quite get at it. As I put in my testimony, I tried to provide some backstory to some things that have happened in the last 2.5 years or so that have really advanced us forward. And in short, the Attorney General did a number of public records orders to a couple of agencies, and in doing so clarified the way we ought to look at the proprietary information issue and what is really proprietary versus what really the public ought to know. And in our opinion, very well-reasoned opinions that should hopefully stand the test of time outside of the legislative process and help guide both the decisions of the legislature and of the executive branch. In any event, as a result of those public records orders and the work of this legislature, a lot more information is now out there. That's a good thing. Oregon is doing a lot better. You have more tools available to you as you evaluate these kinds of programs. What Senate Bill 515 does is memorializes a lot of the things that have already happened, namely the posting of annual reports for many of the programs that we're talking about, which is really what this is all about, the thing that's been at issue. So that's a good thing, and it would be good to memorialize it so we don't forget some of the lessons we've learned over the last 2 years. I should say one other thing, which is just our analysis is that legislation will only get you so far, and that the executive branch has a responsibility here as well to steward these programs once they've been handed over to them. And one other thing that we have been calling on the executive branch to do, in particular the previous governor, and we'll be doing this with our current governor, is to have an executive order that just clarifies the principles of what transparency, how transparency ought to be built into how we administer all the various tax programs, and we think that that ought to happen as well to memorialize it. It hasn't, but it should. As far as the Dash Ones, we're okay with it, so hopefully we encourage you to pass the bill.
Thank you.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I'm appearing in support of Senate Bill 515. Specifically, we are appearing in support of this provision in 515 related to public notices and the posting of public notices on the website. The League believes that this is a good and reasonable step in modernizing our public notice statutes. I would point out that other states have gone to a very efficient electronic reporting system of public notices. Utah, in particular, allows their citizens to subscribe to not just the local governments or the unit of government, but the division and the specific boards. And it's a very affordable and achievable system. But 515 and simply allowing an electronic posting, we think is a good step in modernizing that public record statutes. The current requirement is to post in a print newspaper public notices. Readership declines. We don't think the statute currently meets its intended purpose. Largest paper in the state has gone to a 3-day-a-week circulation. I think we are going to have to find a better way to keep our citizens informed on public meetings, and the electronic notice provision in 515 is a good first step.
Thank you. Questions? Seeing none, thanks very much. And next up is Stacy Cowan and Tricia Smith. Well, whenever you're here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. Ms. Cowan asked me to give you her regrets. She submitted her testimony in writing. There are many other committees meeting at the same time on many pieces of legislation, and she was pulled away.
But hardly as interesting
with
as
regret.
This one.
I'm sure that is true, Mr. Chair. I want to just briefly offer OSEA support for Senate Bill 515. OSEA was one of the requesters of House Bill 3035 last session. We have been interested in increasing transparency over the operations of government for many years and work to support the efforts of the legislators who have championed that effort. The transparency website has produced a plan and submitted it to the legislature, I'm not sure to which committees, in the last month or so, February. They submitted their plan, and it addressed the issues in House Bill 3035 and what was possible and what wasn't. And the only cautionary note I would offer you about Senate Bill 515 is that whenever we have asked DAS to put something on the transparency website. The legislature has been loath to appropriate funds for that purpose. And there is a single staff person at DAS who is responsible for this website as in other duties as assigned. And we could reach capacity, and I'm sure, although I don't represent that staff person, I'm certain if you ask that staff person, that they might think they are already there. So at some point, the legislature needs to decide whether or not transparency is important enough to fund a real effort to produce it through that website. This bill may not be that moment. I'll leave that to you. In that case, in any case, we support Senate Bill 515.
Thank you, Tricia. Questions? Seeing none. Thanks a lot. That's all I have signed up to testify on Senate Bills 100, 101, and 515. Is there anybody else who would like to testify on any of those? Going once? Twice? All right. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bills 100, 101, and 115. And now we are still open on Senate Bill 596. And why don't you bring us up to date on that, James?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 596 directs Construction Contractors Board to create a construction flagging contractor license available that would require the contractor to be bonded and carry insurance. Specifies that the flagging contractor license does not authorize licensee to engage in work of general contractor or other subcontractor. We do have a dash one amendment, changes effective date from no later than 180 days after from after passage to July 1st, 2017. No revenue impact, and there is no fiscal impact statement issued yet.
Okay, we'll start off with Courtney Johnson. Welcome.
You're still on? You want to bring up some other panel members? There. Okay. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, Courtney Johnston here today representing Laborers Local 320. I'm going to speak to a little bit of the background of the bill, and then I'm going to let the rest of the experts come up here and tell you what the substance actually does.
Okay.
Senate Bill 596 requires contractors who perform traffic control flagging work to obtain a specialty contractor license from the Construction Contractors Board. That means they'll post a bond and they'll obtain general liability insurance. Right now in Oregon, anyone who provides construction services is required to obtain a bond, which is provided to protect consumers from the consumers receiving services from contractors. However, in Oregon, under Oregon law, the only contractor on a construction job site that is not required to post a bond or obtain a license is flagging contractors. That means, and many of these contractors do work in multiple states, so that means when they go and do work in Washington, they're licensed, they're bonded, they're insured. When they go and do work in California, they're licensed, they're bonded, they're insured. But in Oregon, we don't provide that same level of protection for their employees and for the consumers, the contracting agency that works with them. That they would get if they were located in a neighboring state. Despite the fact that flagging contractors are not required to obtain a license, in Oregon, traffic control flaggers are oftentimes performing the most dangerous work on the job site. And I'm going to let the other panelists speak to that. But what you're going to hear today from them is that when these bad actors fail to pay their employees, there is no direct path to recoup those wages. But the bill before you basically is intended to provide a basic level of accountability that they don't have right now. Earlier this month, this committee here unanimously voted out a bill to create a specialty contractor license with the CCB for contractors who do fire restoration work in order to provide the kind of basic level of consumer protection that we're talking about here today. The Senate body voted that out of the Senate unanimously as well, and this is a similar bill. I participated on that work group. We took lessons learned from that work group, and we modeled this legislation in a similar fashion. A contractor who only holds this license would not be doing the work, would be restricted from doing the work of a general contractor or a traditional subcontractor. And then you'll note that the Dash 1 amendments, the implementation date outlined, we worked with the CCB to do this in a way that could be done efficiently and cost-effectively. We've been supportive of kind of their efforts and their infrastructure changes, and we felt this was the best way for them to implement that. And with this, I'll close.
Questions? Don't see any. Thank you, Courtney. Let's see.
Valsoranzo. Thank you. And Bill Martinek?
Martinek.
No? Oh, there we go. Okay.
Go ahead.
Welcome to the committee.
Morning. Afternoon, I guess it is. I'm supposed to say something like, welcome for hearing me. My name is Val Solorzano. I'm the owner of Coat Flagging. I am a minority contractor for flagging. I am also working in Washington. I carry a CCB license for my company, general liability, and I would like to see this pass because to make sure that it's level playing field for other contractors in the same field. As a contractor, we are the first people on the job before the construction jobs begin, and we're the last ones on the job. We set it up, we tear it down. It's a very dangerous job that we do out there as flaggers. And so it'd be very important for this to pass because it makes us be one of the, like another general contractor out there, and we're not being treated that way right now. The cost for a CCB license is like, what, $350 and then 11 hours of online education to get your CCB license. So it's not a big thing for other companies to do this.
So what do you believe this bill does that would make it better?
I think it would be level playing field for all of us out there to be part of the contracting world. I mean, because we're the only ones without a CCB license, we're not being treated like other contractors out there. This is like the stepchildren to contractors because we don't really count, even though we're saving lives of all these people out there.
So asking for more regulation. Okay. Go ahead, sir.
Good afternoon, Chairman Beyer and other members of the committee. My name is Bill Martinek. I live out in the Staten area. I am a general contractor and have operated a construction company, Emery & Sons Construction, in the Willamette Valley. And I'm also here representing the Utility Contractors Association of Oregon and Southwest Washington. As general contractors, we provide a lot of different services throughout the state, building utilities, underground utilities, highways, bridges. Some of the projects that my company is currently working on is the Selwood Bridge project that you may be familiar with. We're also working on several segments of the Lake Oswego raw and finished waterline project. So on the projects that we work on, we employ a multitude of subcontractors to provide various portions of the work. And one of the most important ones is for traffic control, flaggers. And so that's an area that, as Val said, it's a very important aspect of the project. It's one of the areas where safety to our workers as well as the traveling public is paramount. It's you'll hear later on some testimony about the number of workplace fatalities that occur every year due to either traffic control or the traveling public. So when we hire subcontractors, it's odd that it's not possible for us to hire a subcontractor to fix a water sprinkler or to trim a tree without that subcontractor being licensed by the state. However, we can hire a flagging subcontractor to control traffic and deal with thousands of cars a day through a traffic zone, and those entities do not universally have to be licensed. Now, in Val's case, she is licensed. What she's asking for is for you to level the playing field and require all contractors or subcontractors that propose to do flagging work to all have some type of licensing. And that's what's missing right now. And so that's what we're asking for, is that the field playing field be leveled for all businesses in the traffic control industry.
Okay. Questions? Seeing none, thank you both.
Thank you.
Dave Tischer, Paloma Sparks.
Good
I'll go first. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dave Tischer. I'm the business manager of Labor Local 320. I've been in that position for the last 11 years. We have about 1,000 members in the heavy construction industry and includes traffic control flaggers. The reason that we introduced this bill, it was actually, there were several reasons. First and foremost, if you look at the ODOT statistics on traffic control and worksite fatalities, it's pretty astounding. You know, they average about 9 fatal crashes a year. Of that, 80% are motorists that are killed, and 20% are the workers. And first and foremost, I don't know why any contracting agency or the public should be put in front of that kind of situation without knowing who you're doing business with. It's very dangerous. It's very serious. There's been several fatalities since I've been business manager, and it, as far as I've seen in my work, it's the most dangerous out there. Secondly, is basically over the past several years and going back quite a ways, this industry has caused the most non-paid of wages claims of any industry in the construction that I know. There's been several multi-thousand dollar claims that have been filed. Most recently, there was a big claim just filed against the Selwood Bridge. And unfortunately, when that happens, the people that get stuck with it are the general contractor, because this person is not bonded, this person is not insured, this person had, there's no liability per se for that contractor. It goes right to the general. In my personal experience, I had a situation with the contractor, and he had working in 4 different cities all over the state of Oregon. I had 12 members who basically, the file that I had was this thick on one contractor over a set of jobs. And basically, by the time the smoke cleared, it took over 9 months for these folks to get their money through the process of the Bureau of Labor and the fact that they had to go after the general contractors. Some of the people missed bill payments. They had all kinds of issues. And unfortunately, some of the people that actually were working for this contractor were doing work for the university system down in Corvallis and Eugene doing football games. And there was no bond to attach. So basically, they didn't get paid at all. The subcontractor got paid. You know, he gets dinged twice. The worker doesn't get paid. It's a mess. Well, this will not solve the problem 100%, but I'll tell you what, it will kind of weed out the bad actors, because after the first time, you know, you're only going to get one bite on that apple. So those are the two main reasons we did this. I thank you for letting me testify before you today, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions you have.
So Dave, the main driver behind this is the bonding, which you think would make it possible for workers who were not paid to recover?
Well, it's actually threefold, Mr. Chairman. Basically, they're not treated the same as any other contractor on the job site. They have no liability insurance for anything that happens in those work zones. And the bonding, it's much more streamlined to try and get the money from that contractor through their bond than having to have the industry, you know, Bureau of Labor to go after it, and the amount of money it costs them. I don't even know what the bill was for this one, but I'll tell you what, it probably wasn't good for the citizens of Oregon to have to do that.
Questions?
Thompson? On the education to get this licensing, I heard it mentioned you can go online, spend 11 hours, and get your license for this. Yeah, so you don't physically have to go to, like somebody in Eastern Oregon doesn't have to physically go to Portland somewhere and spend a couple of days to get the license. They can do it anywhere in the state.
Mr. Chair, I'm not an expert on how to get a CCB license, so the contractors that spoke would be more the ones to ask that question.
I assume it's just a standard CCB license. Miss, other questions? Ms. Sparks.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, Paloma Sparks from the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We're just here to testify in support of Senate Bill 596. Currently, if an employee comes to the Bureau with a wage claim against a flagging contractor, the only thing we can do to collect it is to either ask the contractor to pay, which if they've gone to this point, it's not going to usually happen that way. And then we send it to Department of Revenue to do standard collections. If there was a CCB bond, we could transfer that wage claim that we had gone through a full and complete investigation to determine was owed. We could transfer that to CCB, and they could collect against the bond, which would then make it so more employees were likely to get paid the wages they were due.
Paloma, the question I have is, and I don't remember the formal name of the fund that we had to compensate workers whose employer didn't pay them, the collection through BOLI. Why does that not work?
Chair Beyer, the Wage Security Fund, which I think is probably what you're thinking of, is for where employers have gone out of business. Mm-hmm. So you can collect up to $4,000 in wages that are due from an employer that's gone out of business. A lot of these folks are not employers that necessarily have gone out of business. They just haven't paid their workers.
Senator Thompson?
Paloma, is this rampant in the flagging world? Is there one person out there that's done this wrong? Can you give me, does this happen a lot? What's your experience on this industry having issues with, like, not paying wages and stuff?
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, I don't think it's any larger than any other industry. I think that this bill could help streamline the ability to collect and make it more like other construction contractors.
Follow up. So has there been any this year that you know of?
It's pretty early.
Or last year? I mean,
Chair Beyer,
we saw one example. Is there?
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, I do not know the answer to that.
Thanks. Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
In answer to your question, it's not just one person that does it. There have been several, at least a half a dozen over the last 4 or 5 years. And one of the problems with not having any type of regulation is that these folks just form another company. And they go out there and they just create another entity. They bankrupt this one, create another entity over here, and they're up doing business over and over again. With the licensing and bonding, it's on your Social Security number, so basically it's going to tie you to that work as opposed to you being able to just dodge the bullet. And in answer to your question of the biggest claim, there was a $70,000 claim put on the Selwood Bridge last year.
Wow. Okay. Thanks.
Any other questions? Thank you much.
Thank you for time.
Okay, Mr. Mullis. Welcome, John.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullis, representing the Oregon State Building Trades Council. And you've already heard from the experts a lot of facts and figures, so I'm not going to repeat those. But I just did want to say that our council wanted to go on record in support of this bill. And in general, I can't say that this happens more to as far as contractors that don't pay their wages and then the workers have to try and recover their wages. I can't factually say that it happens more with flagging contractors than it does with mason contractors or painting contractors or any other subcontractors. But I can tell you that when an employee of a mason contractor or a painting contractor or anybody else that's required to be licensed or bonded, those workers have a much better chance of recovering their wages either from that bond or the general will watch them much closer, because the general knows if that sub doesn't pay, then the general is going to be liable because they know that flagging contractor doesn't have a bond. So I think this would do a great deal to ensure that these workers get paid in the first place, and if they don't get paid in the first place, they're going to recover their money in a much quicker fashion.
So given the nature of the businesses, we've heard it today, John, why wouldn't the generals watch it even more closely now?
Chair Beyer, I think in some cases they do. But sometimes, and I don't think it happens very often, but sometimes contractors deliberately cheat. They submit falsified certified payrolls. I think that's the far minority of the time. I don't want to say that that's prevalent. And I think generally they do. But my sense is if a contractor feels that things are going along well, they don't pay attention. And sometimes workers, especially if it's a vulnerable workforce, will not get paid for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks. And they keep saying, well, you're going to get paid, don't worry about it, and they won't complain until it's too late. Hmm.
It is interesting. I mean, you may know the history of why they weren't included. Every other construction trade seems to be covered in terms of contractors in this way. Why wasn't this one?
And Chair Beyer, I honestly do not know the answer to that question. I do not know.
Question to John. Senator Monroe.
Most of these employees are women.
I don't know that most of them are, but I think there is probably a higher excuse me, Chair Beyer, Senator Monroe. I think there's probably a pretty high percentage of women in the flagging trades, probably as high or higher than in a lot of the other crafts.
Point made.
Okay. You're saying they're not covered. No, I'm not going there.
I'm just wanting to make a point.
Other questions? Thank you, John.
Okay, thank you very much.
That's all I have signed up to testify on Senate Bill 596. Is there anybody else? Y'all, come on. Got another comment?
Yes.
Welcome back, Bill.
Chairman Beyer and members of the committee, I did want to come back again, Bill Martinek, to address one of the questions from Senator Thompson about the CCB. So, with your permission,
okay,
address that.
Sure.
The Construction Contractors Board has become a very easily navigated entity at the state of Oregon. The online registration, the online community or continuing education system is extremely easy for anyone to navigate. It's quick and easy. Renewal can be done totally online as long as you keep your education credits in place. I renewed one of my contractor licenses this year. It took me about 15 minutes, and I paid online with a credit card. So it's extremely, it's not a difficult thing, even if you live in Burns, Oregon.
Okay, so Bill, I think one of the senator's questions was the 11 hours of training. Was that right?
Well, I just wanted to make sure.
Go ahead.
Mr. I just wanted to make sure that somebody in Burns or Ontario didn't have to go spend 3 days in Portland to take this test and upgrade their license and answer the question.
Initially, there is some time required to be qualified, but it's not 3 days coming to the Valley to do that.
Oh, so I'll follow up then. So do the individual flaggers have to take this test too?
Just a contract.
There is a flagging certificate certain projects, as working on an ODOT project. Then that individual flagger does need to take a class and be certified. They have to be trained by a certified teacher. And that class, that's about a one-day class, and in order to perform on certain projects. That's not every project requires that.
So that exists today.
Yeah, but most of the flaggers that we use, we want them to have at least that minimum level of training to do that. And one other item, you talked about whether the issues were prevalent in the flagging industry. So in the last, I've been in the construction business for about 40 years. We've had one issue of this type with an electrician and five with flaggers. So it's an issue that needs to be addressed.
It's an issue. Okay. Other questions?
Thanks again. But thank you for allowing me to testify today.
One more time. Anybody else wish to testify? All right. We're going to close the public hearing on 596 then. And we will bring that back another day. And now we're going to open on, do I really want to do 20? I guess I do. House Bill 2330. James.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2330 allows converting business entity, limited liability corporation, or nonprofit corporation to file written declaration stating location where plan of conversion is on file and stating that converting entity will provide any owner with a copy of the plan upon request and without cost in lieu of submitting plans to the Secretary of State. Modifies documents required to be filed with Secretary of State upon approval of plan to merge or share exchange. Requires written notice of dissenters' rights be delivered to all shareholders entitled to notice when corporate action creates dissenters' rights is authorized by written consent without meeting. We do have a dash one amendment. It adds provisions to mergers and conversions for cooperative corporations similar to mergers and conversions for other types of business entities. There is no revenue impact and there's no fiscal impact with that amendment.
Okay, thank you. Kenny Haglund.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Kenny Haglund. I'm an attorney with Lane Powell in Portland. I'm also a member of the executive committee of the business law section of the Oregon State Bar. I was on a legislative task force that looked at a couple proposals to update the corporate law in Oregon. We settled on two proposals that are set forth in this bill. The first is that when two entities merge in Oregon, the survivor will have to file articles of merger with the Secretary of State. They also have to file a plan of merger as a copy or as an attachment to the articles of merger. The bill will remove that requirement, and instead they can state where the plan of merger is and that the shareholder can obtain that free of charge. There's two issues with filing the plan of merger. One is that it's a document that's typically not suitable for filing. It contains a bunch of confidential information about the businesses. And so what happens is the attorneys on the deal will prepare kind of a short form plan of merger that can be attached. And this adds cost and expense to the merger. It also, the second issue with it is that it is set forth on a document that's not a form provided by the Secretary of State. So it requires careful review by the staff at the Oregon Corporation Division and is often a reason that the filing is rejected. The second issue addressed with the bill is a little over 10 years ago, Oregon corporate law was revised to allow shareholders to take action by non-unanimous consent. So as long as enough shareholders sign a document, that would be able to approve a transaction at a meeting. It can be approved through that written consent as long as that authority is granted in the articles. Shareholders that don't consent are still entitled to dissenters' rights under Oregon law, but the dissenters' rights process and statute wasn't updated when that new ability was done. And so the bill addresses that and clarifies the procedure to follow. Shareholders that didn't consent to the transaction within 10 days of the transaction would have to get a notice by the company on how they can exercise their dissenters' rights, and then they could send a letter in and follow the procedure.
How about the amendment?
Sorry?
The proposed amendment?
The proposed amendment, it revises the statute in the corporate law, the nonprofit. Oh, I'm sorry, the amendment relating to cooperatives. Okay, so the bill right now addresses the plan of merger in corporate law, limited liability companies, nonprofits, all that. And I think cooperatives were inadvertently omitted from that. And it basically just does the same thing for them. And I haven't had a lot of chance to look at it, but I would think that I took a quick look and it follows the other procedures and looks to be something we would recommend and support.
Questions? I don't see any.
Thank you.
Anybody from the department have any concerns? Cosgrove. Paul.
It should be on 278.
Oh, wrong one.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot. But it got him awake.
I take blame.
All right. Nobody else has anything? Okay. So we will close public hearing. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2330. Can I move it? Dash one. Move it. No, you got to make the motion.
I got to make the motion. This is new. I move House Bill 2330 to the...
You need a dash one first.
Oh, yes. Colleagues, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2330.
We're going to file a minority report on this one?
Senator has moved the dash one amendments to House Bill 2330. It's a House bill. We're not used to this yet. Is there any discussion on the... Any discussion? Seeing none, is there any opposition? The amendment's adopted.
I move House Bill 2330 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
As amended by the dash ones?
As amended by the dash ones. Thank you.
Senator has moved House Bill 2330 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion. Is there any opposition? House Bill 2330, as amended by the dash ones, this moves to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Who wants to carry?
I can do it.
It's done. Okay, now let's see. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 278. James.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 278 voids loans of $50,000 or less issued by unlicensed lenders to Oregon consumers, prohibits unlicensed lenders, collection agencies, and financial institutions from collecting on unlicensed loans, allows the Department of Consumer and Business Services to account for persons who have made loans while holding a lapse license, declares emergency effective on passage, becomes operative 91 days after effective date of measure. We have two amendments. The dash one amendment clarifies that if license lapses, the loan is voidable but not voided. The dash two amendment enables state courts to rescind consumer finance loan of $50,000 or less, payday loan or and title loan, as well as restore unlicensed lender and the consumer to respective economic positions prior to a transaction if the court finds that the lender's license inadvertently or mistakenly lapsed. There is no revenue or no fiscal for either amendment.
Mr. Chapman. We heard this one before. We've got a couple of amendments.
Likes the dash one, but he doesn't like the dash two.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, David Tapman from the Department of Consumer Business Services, and to Mr. Monroe's point, actually it's the reverse.
Yeah.
The other way around?
The reverse, yeah. Okay. I told you.
Okay.
So the dash ones essentially would gut the bill. Essentially put the bill where it currently is, void versus voidable. We had the discussion about what those two things mean. Happy to take questions. Two things that we were charged with by this committee. One was the issue that came up from Mr. Cosgrove. It was a concern that somebody who would inadvertently let their license lapse would no longer be allowed to engage in this business. I just want to reassure the agents, the committee, that in fact the law has already been addressed by the legislature. ORS 725.140 subsection 2 expressly states that unless and until the agency revokes the license, and by revocation I mean takes the formal steps that are required under the Administrative Procedures Act of sending a formal legal notice, giving the person 60 days to have the hearing, and then go forward with the process, that license continues to exist. It does not lapse. And so that process provides more than enough assurance that somebody will have that opportunity. In fact, that's such a rarity that it's unusual, and it's limited just to these two entities. Of course, within that 60-day notice, there'd be plenty of opportunity for the individual to get their license in good standing. But as long as they are licensed, they can make these loans, provided the loans meet the criteria that the legislature created in terms of interest rate caps and limitations on rollovers and the like. So we think that the law already provides for what Mr. Cosgrove was concerned about. The second issue that came up was what we call legally unjust enrichment. That's where the borrower would be in a position to receive the proceeds from the loan unjustly because they took the money and then they said, oh, you're not licensed, therefore that's illegal conduct, therefore the loan is void and you can't collect the loan. Under the laws of equity, which these courts in Oregon provide for, there's a provision that says there is not unjust enrichment and that the party, in this case the lender, could come forward and file with the court and ask that the court rescind the contract and put the parties back to where they originally were. Therefore, the money that was loaned would then be returned to the lender, and any fees or interest paid by the borrower would be returned to the borrower, therefore putting the two parties back to square one. That is a provision that we think provides more sense than allowing for unlicensed lenders who are engaged in making loans far and above the current rate of 36%, as we discussed at great length last time, being allowed to continue to do that without any kind of limitation. Therefore, I think we've addressed the two issues that this committee had asked for, and I'm ready to answer any questions you might have.
Questions? Okay. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Mr. Cosgrove. I'm guessing you disagree.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Paul Cosgrove, representing Oregon Financial Services Association. Section 1 of the bill is what applies to the people in our association, the consumer finance licensees. Just to take you back where we started from, if you look at the bill itself without any amendments, on page 2, the bill is drafted by the department, says that the director by order may determine whether and how a person may collect interest, fee, or charge when a license lapsed inadvertently or by mistake. So that was how the department started, is to take into account that could happen inadvertently. Our dash one, I take exception, doesn't gut the bill. All it says is that those things that lapse by mistake, you can collect the interest and principal. That's all the dash one does. What the dash 2 does effectively voids all those loans and causes the parties to institute litigation. I think given where the bill started with the director having discretion, our dash 1 is a reasonable amendment to that by saying if they were licensed and the license lapsed, they ought to be able to collect the principal and interest, and the dash 2 isn't necessary. The one concern I have about the dash 2, if the committee is interested in it, is if you look on the dash 2 on line 13, it proposes to delete these very lines 1 through 4 on dash 2, taking away the discretion from the director to have the director decide whether principal and interest can be collected. And I think that's a step backwards. Mm-hmm. So I would argue, in contrast to Mr. Tatman, who likes the 2 and doesn't like the 1, the Oregon Financial Service Association thinks that the dash 1 is a reasonable modification to the bill as introduced by the department and doesn't have the problems that the dash 2 does. So I'd urge the dash 1.
Dave, can I ask you to come back up and address the need for the I mean, you heard his comments.
We just have him arm wrestle.
The need for the dash twos.
Mr. Chair, first of all, David Tatman again. I'm not seeing the dash one, so I apologize for that. But what Mr. Cosgrove describes is, I think the key issue is that somebody who has been licensed. And if it's limited to somebody who's been licensed and it lapses, as I've indicated, I don't believe that situation.
Because they can just renew their license.
Mr. Chair, in fact, the license never expires until and unless we revoke it. So it will lapse. But assuming, for sake of the discussion, that it could lapse, I think Mr. Cosgrove's point is if limited to just the lapse license by a licensee and assuming that the loan was in compliance with the law, I don't have a problem with that because their interest rates would be within the standards set forward in Chapter 725. So I'm not in disagreement with Mr. Cosgrove on that. I just wanted to make sure we addressed the issue about somebody who was unlicensed. And so we can accept the dash ones and pull the dash twos.
Now we're changing.
Pull the dash twos, accept the dash ones.
I think we should take a photograph.
Just put in support, or neutral at least.
I think we should take a photograph.
Better move the dash ones.
Here, let's take it.
Before we
Do that again.
You want to report that?
Okay.
Senator Riley appears to have a question, though.
I do. The amendment.
We're going to close. Oh, I'm sorry. You asked a question?
I do. The amendment deletes some language, and I'm trying to find what that is. Can somebody tell me what line we're looking at? Ones?
Yeah, dash one. There you go.
I want to hit that thing too hard. You wake up Gerard.
That hurt my ear.
I didn't hit it.
My ear's ringing.
I didn't even hit it. You got a question still?
We'll wait a couple. No.
No, I'm good. Thank you.
You okay?
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 278. Senator Monroe.
Mr. Chair, I would move the Dash 1 amendments.
Senator Monroe has moved the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 278. Discussion on that motion. Is there any opposition to that motion? There is none. Dash 1s are adopted. Senator
Mr.
Monroe.
Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment. No? No. I thought he wanted them both.
No, he said he didn't want them.
No.
Just move the bill.
Just the one? Okay.
Troublemaker. Troublemaker.
No, they're both happy with the dash one.
Just the dash one. Okay.
So just the bill.
Fine. I move the bill. It's amended.
Senator Monroe has moved the Senate Bill 278 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Is there any, how do I say that?
In opposition.
Opposition to the motion.
I oppose.
Okay. Okay, so the bill is passed to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Senator Gerard is a no. And who wants to carry? Senator Riley, you want to carry that?
I'll carry it.
Senator Riley wants to carry that. He read the amendment. We're closed.
Senator Riley, we're happy. Senator Riley, we're happy.